This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
Tom Wilmer reporting from Carmel, California. Come along and join me as we visit with Jill Dutton. One of her passions is riding the rails, riding trains across America. Tell us a little bit of background and what you do and why you do it.
Sure, Tom, and thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I would say that my interest in train travel originated when I was 12, almost 13 years old, and my sister was stationed in Augsburg, Germany. And so my mom and I went to Europe for 3 months, and we used my sister as a home base while we camped and hosteled and did the whole backpacking through Europe kind of thing. And we had a Eurail pass, and so we just lived on the train as much as we possibly could. So when I got the idea to become a travel writer with a focus on train travel in the U.S., my mom at the time said, you've got to write a USA by rail because, you know, the Europe by Year rail was my Bible. I live by that book in Europe. And I said, well, Mom, there already is a USA by rail. But I ended up focusing more on specific routes. So I'm currently writing Ride the Southwest Chief, which is from Chicago to L.A., and it's more detailed as far as what to do, where to get off, and it highlights the most valuable parts of the train is that the stations are normally right in the middle of town.
Kind of Route 66?
Yes, and so like the Southwest Chief, though, you know, you're going to land right in the center of Albuquerque, and you're going to get off the train, and so the train guides show you what's the closest hotel, how to get around in that city. And
back up, this is a book?
Actually, it'll be 12 different train guides based on the route.
And you do an ongoing blog, right?
I do. It's usabyrail.blog.
Tell us about some of your recent journeys and adventures. That's why you're here in the Monterey Peninsula right now.
Absolutely. I had yet to ride on the Coast Starlight, so I was excited when I found out we were coming to San Francisco that I could pick up the Coast Starlight and ride from Oakland to Salinas. Probably one of my most recent trips was I spent 2 weeks traveling Virginia by train. And so I live in Kansas City, which is not real convenient to get anywhere by train. So I took Kansas City to Chicago to D.C., and then took the Northeast Regional train down to Hampton, Virginia, and started there and went to 5 different cities in Virginia, getting off every couple days and visiting a different city. Really fun trip.
Did you ever do Pullman, or did you just make do and cook?
I've done both. What happens, I'm pretty frugal, and so I'll buy like a 2-week rail pass, which is $450 for 8 stops in 15 days. So it's an affordable way to get around. But what happens usually by the end of the trip, I'm tired, and that's when I'll end up getting a sleeper car at that time.
Somebody said they would come to the conductor around midnight and rent a Pullman just for overnight.
It used to be, and I'm referencing my mom again because she was real big into train travel as well. And she had told me when I first started 5 years ago riding Amtrak that you could wait until the last minute, and as soon as you get on, ask them, and then you could get it at a discount. Well, they got smart to that and canceled it to where now it starts costing more for a sleeper car the closer you get because they won't do that anymore.
Hit list priority, the reasons why, the benefits. You know, why do you advocate and recommend traveling by rail?
For myself personally, I mean, you've got to have the time. You have to be willing to spend the time. But if you're not in a hurry to get somewhere, it's the best mode of travel, in my opinion. The scenery. If you're driving, you cannot pay attention to the scenery. You have to make bathroom breaks. You don't have food, you know, hot, good food, you know, available.
I'll interrupt for a moment. Food on the train.
Okay.
People roll their eyes, and yet things have changed and are changing.
Yes. Now, because there have been some changes on long-distance trains, getting rid of the dining car, but the dining car, I love the dining car. And so if you're in a sleeper car, it's included in the price of it, and it's so nice because you go in, and it's community seating, so you get to meet. Honestly, I've met quite a few retired pilots that they just enjoy the pace of train now, and it's nothing against flying. They just love the pace now that they're retired. And so you get to sit with people from different states and meet them and sometimes different countries. So I love that because that's very European in the sense of sharing tables and getting to meet people and dine together. It's great. But the last train ride I took was from D.C. to Chicago, and they had gotten rid of the dining car on that one. So,
but they still have food, but it's more...
It's going to be more
packed
lunches kind of things.
The other interesting thing, riding the train across America, is when you go through cities and towns, you sometimes see a very different city than you see on the interstate.
Oh, completely. When I took the California Zephyr, which goes from Chicago to San Francisco, basically, I went through Colorado, and you travel through places that there are no phone wires, there are no highways. You are seeing things that no one else can see of the country. And it's gorgeous, absolutely stunning. I mean, you're going through the Rocky Mountains with the Colorado River running alongside the train, and you look out the window, and it's a drop-off. I mean, it's just, it's spectacular.
Talk to us about your ideal routing itinerary. In a perfect world, how many days would you stay on the train? Would you get off every day or every other?
That's a good, very good question. For myself, because I like to stay in coach, and I can sleep on coach, the chairs are comfortable, and you've got plenty of leg room. I don't have a problem with that, but you're going to go without showering and, you know, things like that. So 2 days is usually my limit, but ideal for me is like 24 hours. From Kansas City to Flagstaff is about 24 hours. So that's a perfect one. So I would break that up, get off there, and then go to L.A. from there.
Cost, affordability, mm-hmm. How affordable is it to travel by rail?
Normally, I get the two-week pass. Like I mentioned, it's 8 stops in 15 days. Now, when you change trains, that does count as a stop. So I have to change trains in Chicago, so that counts as one of my 8.
Spend the night in Chicago.
I can. I don't usually, only because I'm anxious to get to my first destination when I first get on the train. So that's real affordable. But then sometimes I found, like in the case of Virginia, when I went to Virginia, it wound up being cheaper for me to, just because my stops were so close together. Sometimes it's $15 or $20 to go from one city to the next. And so it's very affordable to buy. I don't want to waste my 8 stops on these ones that are so close together. So if you go to USA by Rail and you can look up different destinations, you'll see some of my train articles that tell tips on how to get around and the best way and the cheapest routes. And
talk to us about advanced planning and an advantage of that.
Yes. I work a few months in advance just because I'm taking long trips. But I've met couples that, this was also a retired pilot, but they had traveled the whole Canadian train route from one end to the next, and then came down on the U.S. side and were going back on the, you know, through Niagara Falls and just the whole upper U.S. I think it took them several months to plan theirs, you know, because you're lining up lodging and how often you want to get off. And so, you know, the Amtrak's got a really good interactive site to be able to see the maps and plan how often you want to get off the train.
Again, for the person that doesn't mind a brutal travel, we were talking earlier about you can buy a pass that is transcontinental for like $250.
Oh, yes. There's a popular article that gets shared around of going from one end of the country to the other. And I believe if you just buy it straight through, but that involves staying on the train in coach for, like I said, about 4 days without getting off to get that $200-some price.
Favorite tips and recommendations?
I'm big on bringing a cooler, because one of the benefits of Amtrak is that you can bring 4 pieces of luggage. And this is without checking a bag or anything. You can have your good-sized luggage. So I bring my big luggage with my clothes. I will bring a good-sized backpack with my computer, my cameras, and all of my equipment. Then I will also bring a personal item and a cooler. And I don't bring a large cooler, but it's important to me to have cheese and fruit and things. You just seem to crave real food, because if you're not doing the dining car, the cafe car is kind of expensive, and it's just microwaved hot dogs and things. So it's not my favorite place. So I prefer to have my own food. So I will bring a cooler with frozen bottles of water and things I might not eat at home. Really good cheese, really good, maybe some prosciutto or something, and some bread. Then when I get to like Chicago or one of the other main stations and change trains, they've got some really good delis that you could get a really nice sandwich or something. You just want something fresh on the train. Mm-hmm. At least I do. And the cafe car will give you ice to restock.
Do they have bar cars anymore?
Yes, that's the cafe car. I've run out of food in my cooler on the way home on the train, and I did the hot dog and the half bottle of wine sitting down in the cut. It's fun. It's just I don't like to eat them too often. You know?
Okay, so your most recent excursion was getting on in Oakland and getting off in Salinas, California.
Yes, yes.
What do you remember outstanding about that journey?
One of the things I like, and I don't work for Amtrak. This is something I enjoy about Amtrak, and it also pertains when I go to Santa Fe, New Mexico. The train station in that situation, I was going to Monterey, and there was not a train station in Monterey. So Amtrak lines it up to where they will schedule shuttles and things to get you. So I went from San Francisco to Monterey by train, but I took 2 buses. But they had it, you know, the shuttle is waiting for you.
So you got off in Salinas.
Salinas, and the shuttle was waiting for us. And so they're great at scheduling that, because the train was delayed, but they said, your transportation will be waiting.
The name of that train is what?
the Coast Starlight, one of the most scenic, popular train routes that there in the U.S.
It must be that next on your list is
to ride the entire, yeah, from Seattle to L.A. Yes, I had it on my calendar the year I went through Colorado, but there were mudslides here at the time, and so because I booked so many stops, they were having 24-hour delays or putting people on buses because of the mudslides in California, and so I decided to reschedule. That's the only reason I haven't done the whole route yet.
Before we go, let's have you share some of your favorite scenic routes.
Absolutely.
Just for the journey itself.
Like I mentioned, I'm really looking forward to when I get to ride the Coast Starlight all the way. Probably my favorite was the California Zephyr that went through Colorado. I stopped in Glenwood Springs and Winter Park and Grand Junction on that particular trip, but I've done some fall foliage trips, and those are very popular. The Northeast area, like people, you go through to Vermont, it's supposed to be spectacular. I mean, the one of the best fall foliage, but I took one that just fell in love with the area was through West Virginia. I believe it's a Cardinal train. I don't have it in front of me, but it goes from Chicago and it goes through West Virginia, and I was able to stop in Huntington, Charleston, and Lewisburg, which is White Sulphur Springs, where the Greenbrier Resort is, that the president has the bunker, and yeah. But it's similar to Colorado in the sense that, but the mountains are different. You know, the Smoky Mountains, and it's a very sweet area. But so the fall foliage, and it follows the river, and it's, you just can't beat it.
To learn more about Jill Dutton's world of riding the rails,
usabyrail.blog.
We've been visiting with Jill Dutton. We'll see you on the rails. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. Thanks again, Jill. In celebration of the 30th anniversary of Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, airing over NPR affiliate KCBX, we're sharing some of the best of the best of the radio shows and podcasts over the last 30 years. Come along and join us for a rebroadcast of a show about historic railroads across America, originally broadcast in 2013. At one time, not that long ago, travel by train was the way to go. But with the advent of the automobile and a nationwide network of highways and byways, the era of the rail was doomed. But the love affair with steam engines and parlor cars never died. Across America, there are numerous historic railroads that offer the traveler nostalgic train trips back in time. I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me as we ride the rails. Our first stop is the Grand Canyon Railway in Arizona.
Well, the Grand Canyon Railway has been taking passengers to the Grand Canyon since 1901, when it was built as a spur line by the Santa Fe Railway.
Before we head out of Arizona, we'll climb aboard the Verde Valley Railroad, located not too far from Sedona.
The railroad started in 1912. It was originally for the mines in Jerome.
And then we'll ride in the cab with the engineer aboard the Cumbres and Toltec Railroad in northern New Mexico.
I'm Tracy Caraway. I'm an engineer on the Cumbres and Toltec Scenic Railroad. We run from Chama, New Mexico to Antonita, Colorado.
Afterwards, it's time to discover the Tennessee Valley Railroad on the outskirts of Chattanooga.
We're going to go through two tunnels today. One is two-thirds of a mile long. Another one is one-half a mile long. One of them happens to be curved. The guys that dug those tunnels out were highly skilled. Dug out in 1903.
Virginia was an East Coast hub of railroading and remains a vital center for freight car manufacturing and repair. We'll visit with the director of the Virginia Museum of Transportation in Roanoke.
And our real claim to fame is that we have a lot of railroad equipment, a couple of locomotives which were literally designed and built here in Roanoke by Norfolk and Western employees from mostly the 1930s through the 1950s.
And before we head out of town, we'll stop in for a bite to eat at the iconic historic Texas Tavern in downtown Roanoke.
You just say, I want one. If you want onions on it, it's one with. If you want a hot dog, you order as a hot. So if you want everything on it, you order as with. If you come in, you order a bowl of chili, you don't say a bowl of chili with onions, you just say bowl with. If you want a hamburger with everything on it, one with. Cheesy Western is just a cheesy.
Last but not least, we'll hop on over to Maui to check out the Lahaina and Kanapali sugarcane train.
Basically a continuation of a railroad that started in 1882 to haul the sugarcane from the fields into the mill.
Bruce Brossman with the Grand Canyon Railroad.
Tell us about, number one, the Grand Canyon Railway. What a great way to get there.
Well, the Grand Canyon Railway has been taking passengers to the Grand Canyon since 1901, when it was built as a spur line by the Santa Fe Railway. In 1905, El Tovar Hotel was constructed, and it was operated by the Fred Harvey Company, which was already a partner with the Santa Fe Railway and many other towns. It prospered through the early 1900s as it put the stagecoaches out of business, and it was the easiest way and most comfortable way to get to the, and the cheapest way to get to the Grand Canyon. As the automobiles rapidly became popular, train travel started to decline. And in 1969, the Grand Canyon Railway stopped carrying passengers to the Grand Canyon. The track sat idle until 1989, when a couple entrepreneurs bought the tracks and brought back the train.
For a moment, tell us about the gunfire in the background.
Well, that's where the Cataract Creek gang gets shot because they stole some horses and robbed some tourists and cheated them out of their money here in the Wild West show that happens every day at 9 o'clock. It's about a 15-minute show, and you get to know the marshal and the characters. The marshal will ride the train today, and you'll get to know him even better. On the southbound trip, the train will be robbed by the same group that miraculously comes back to life after the sheriff shoots them, and they'll board the train from horseback, and the marshal will chase them through the train, and eventually, of course, they run out of train and they're captured and everybody's safe again.
Let's talk a little bit about once you get there at the other end of the line.
The end of the Grand Canyon Railway is at the second depot that was built at the South Rim. It was built in 1910. It's the oldest log structure still being used as a depot today, an active depot. You're probably 300 yards from the south rim of the Grand Canyon. You get a brief glimpse of it from the train, and then as you get off the train, you have a brief walk up some steep stairs. We do have a handicap disabled shuttle for people who are having mobility issues, maybe not feeling very well. We're at 7,000 feet, so sometimes that can affect people from lower elevations. We do have a lot of people with various handicaps and accessibility challenges. We can lift them up into the train on wheelchairs in coach class and first class. Once you get there, there is a shuttle that will take you there, and the first thing you see is El Tovar, built in 1905 and managed by the Fred Harvey Company. It is still one of the most famous hotels in the national parks. It was one of the fanciest hotels in 1905 when it had water, telephones, and very fine dining, which is what the Fred Harvey Company was known for. So you could dine on oysters and Roquefort cheese and steak and all kinds of fancy food, partly because the train would bring in all that food. The water was also brought in on the train until well into the 40s and 50s. So the train really did develop the South Rim, and the Santa Fe money developed the South Rim. You'll see the Hopi House right across the street from El Tovar, built by Mary Coulter. It was built as a gift shop. People came from the East Coast, so they were on extended trips. So they needed things for these people to do because they were going to stay 4 and 5 days. So there were carriage rides and there were restaurants, of course. They built the Hopi House as a living gift shop in a sense that the Hopi Indians actually lived there. And they would come down and make their wares, their pots, their jewelry, and their rugs. And you could buy a souvenir right from the artist who made it. So back in 1905, this was quite a concept of a interpretive gift shop. And many, many famous people, of course, have visited the Grand Canyon, Albert Einstein just being one. President Clinton fairly recently did stay at El Tovar overnight, which was a big deal while he was president. Laura Bush was there with her daughters. We've had lots of people like that. Of course, the Obamas visited briefly, did not stay overnight. So it's a destination, an international destination. People from all over the world, famous, not so famous, want to see the Grand Canyon, and it's probably the most famous place in America, really, to visit, the most famous national park. For further information, you can go to GrandCanyonLodges.com for history and information on the lodges and all the facilities in the park. And on the train, very hard to remember, thetrain.com.
Oh, that's too hard.
on that website, there are videos. We have coach, first, dome, and luxuries, full access of the train, and also access to the back viewing platform.
Oh, nice. I love that.
You'll be able to go outside the train, look at the scenery going by, maybe see an antelope, an elk.
Plus, you can practice your presidential election speech out there.
You could, yeah, if you have aspirations. It's a wide open field. So, yes, you could practice. John Kerry actually did that at the Grand Canyon during his run. He actually stood on the back of the train and actually visited the Grand Canyon.
All right, Bruce, thank you so much. This has been great.
Thanks, Tom. Nice to meet you.
You too. Faraday Valley, situated in northern Arizona, a short hop from Sedona and Flagstaff. Come along and join us in Faraday Valley, where we board the Faraday Canyon Railroad for a leisurely ride through rugged Red Rock Canyons as we visit with Amber Saravo, the first class supervisor aboard Faraday Canyon Railroad. The Faraday Canyon Railway offers a memorable 4-hour round trip through some of the most spectacular Red Rock Canyons in Arizona. Amber Saravo.
My name is Amber Saravo, and I am the first class supervisor at the Verde Canyon Railroad.
Excellent. Tell us about the history of the railroad and what it is today.
Well, the railroad started in 1912. It was originally for the mines in Jerome, and General Clark started the railroad. And after the mines closed in the 1950s, the railroad kind of stopped for a little while, and then the cement plant opened here in Clarkdale, Arizona, and we started hauling all the freight for the cement plant, and Dave Gerbano bought the railroad, and mostly for freight. And when he realized what was out here in this canyon, he made it an excursion as well.
How often does the train run? Is it every day, twice a day?
Normally the train runs 6 days a week. Tuesday is our maintenance day, but it's kind of a seasonal thing. Summer times we do our night runs. Oktoberfest, of course, we'll do our double trains on the weekends. Wintertime, we slow down a little bit. We do Santa Claus Express in December, and it's 3 days a week. And then January, we run 2 days a week.
Oh, great. Tell us about the Santa Claus Express. That's great.
Santa Claus comes on and sings in every car and reads the Christmas story to all the kids. And there's free hot chocolate and cookies to go with. Put on a great show.
Very, very cool. And tell us about the itinerary. Where does the train go, and what do you see?
Well, we start in Clarkdale, Arizona, and we go to Perkinsville. And Perkinsville is an old mining star, the old train stop, and back when it was a steam locomotive. And now when it switched to diesel locomotive, the town kind of died off because we didn't need it anymore. And now it's still a ranch, still owned by the same family for almost 100 years. And we stop there, and people get to see the old town and where How the West Was Won was filmed, and where our depot starred for about 3 minutes. Pretty exciting. And then we come back through the Verde Canyon, and really the ride is mostly for what you see out here. So you kind of get the same Sedona sights, but without all the people. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to drive. We do it for you.
Great. So it's outside of Cottonwood, which is outside of Sedona and Flagstaff, so it's approachable and close to a lot of places in central Arizona there.
We get people from all over the world, and we get repeat riders from Arizona. They come up here with families, and we host all kinds of special events, weddings, whatever you need. We're pretty good at putting on whatever kind of show you want.
And you can rent the caboose, right, for your family and friends?
The caboose is great. It's $600, up to six people, and it's beautiful. It's mahogany wood, built-in lighting, all stem glassware, one person taking care of you. Pretty much it's your own car for the whole trip. Beautiful, beautiful ride.
And then you have regular coach class and first class cars.
Yes, we have the coach class cars, and it's more like bus-style seating with flip seats. And then first class is more like lounge-style seating with a full cash bar and hors d'oeuvres and a champagne cider toast upon boarding.
Round trip journey is how long?
4 hours round trips, 20 miles up, 20 miles back, so 40 miles. But we only go 12 miles an hour, so it takes about 4 hours. But it's great for picture taking.
And for further information, website?
At verdecanyonrr.com.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This is great.
Thank you very much.
We've been visiting with Amber Saravo aboard the Verde Canyon Railroad. Come along and join us in New Mexico.
Built in 1880, the Denver and Rio Grande Railway instantly became a lifeline for miners, the timber industry, as well as cattle and sheep ranchers throughout the mountain communities of northern New Mexico and southern Colorado. Through boom and bust, the railway continued to serve as the only viable means of transport for many mountain communities in both states until the railway's demise in 1969. Please join us in the mountains of New Mexico near the town of Chama, where we climb aboard the Cumbres and Toltec Scenic Railroad, the modern reincarnation of the old Denver and Rio Grande. Join engineer Tracy Caraway in the cab of the old Baldwin steam engine pulling a load of sightseers across the mountain passes and canyons of northern New Mexico and southern Colorado.
I'm Tracy Caraway. I'm an engineer on the Cumbres and Toltec Scenic Railroad. We run from Chama, New Mexico to Antonita, Colorado. 64 miles. It's a narrow gauge, steam, coal, hand shoveled. The engines were built in 1925, four here. They were shipped from Pennsylvania. You'll travel from 8,000 to 10,000 foot, a number of tall trestles, a couple of tunnels. You got an hour lunch stop in the middle of nowhere, excellent meals. The engines are 85 years old. They were built in 1925. The railroad was built 130 years ago.
When it was first built, what was it for?
It used to haul the gold and silver. Used to could get on in Denver, Colorado and go all the way to Silverton, Colorado. There were gold and silver mines there. They needed some way to transport the minerals themselves to the smelter.
Today there is another line at the other end, isn't there?
Yep. It was all connected at one time, and then an individual bought part of it and the states bought this and they split it half and half.
Is there any thought or talk about making a continuous train trip where you connect them again?
Probably not, but it's definitely something everyone should do once.
And are there some steep grades on here?
Or is it 4%, yep.
So you don't want to be spinning out there.
No, it happens sometimes, yeah. And sure enough, sometimes we'll wake up in the morning, you know, get a light snow, you know, or drizzle from rain, or the leaves falling like they are now, makes the track slippery.
So you bring a little sand along with you?
Yep, there's a sand dome in the front of the engine with a tube runs down to the drivers for traction.
And how long have you been doing this?
I started in 1980.
Wow.
Yep.
So this is your home?
Pretty much. I go away for the winter because we just work from May to October because the snow gets so deep.
So are you a snowbird? You go down south somewhere?
Pretty much. Yeah, I'm from Austin, Texas.
Oh, really?
And in the wintertime, I worked for Hummer. And then when China didn't buy them, well, we pretty much all got our walking papers. So I hate to see that, but things like that happen.
All right. Well, you're still an engineer.
Yep. Yeah, at least I had something, you know, in the summer.
Well, thank you so much. This has been an honor and a pleasure.
You bet. We appreciate you coming and interviewing.
All right. Tom Wilmer reporting from the mountains of New Mexico.
My name's Robert Pelway. I'm a marketing consultant with the Tennessee Valley Railroad Museum, located in Chattanooga, Tennessee, off Highway 153 in Jersey Pike. We're the largest operating railroad in the southeast United States, and we do about 150,000 visitors a year. We operate year-round, and our primary product that we have, in addition to our displays and our display yard, is our Missionary Ridge Local, which we're getting ready to take today, which is our five-time-a-day excursion that we run year-round. It runs 55 minutes on rails that we own and operate, so that we don't have to worry about any commercial traffic interrupting our tour. Takes you through scenic woodlands, over some historical bridges, historical tunnel from 1854, and a lot of this track was actually used recently in the Water for Elephants movie that came out here and did a movie feature. That ends in the East Chattanooga Depot area, and we run both steam and diesel product for that. We've got our new steam engine that we've just recently refurbished coming through right now. Once you get to the East Depot, you depart and you get a tour and you watch the steam engine turn around on one of the few working turntables in the Southeast. And then you take a detailed tour of our shop where we actually do refurbishment of all the equipment that we have donated to us. And we also do work for other railroads across the country through that shop. So in addition to the admissions to the museum for the railroad, we also have some funds that come through from the refurbishments that we do over in the shop. And then you're brought back on the same excursion back to the Chattanooga Depot, and that's our Missionary Ridge product. We also run year-round with Christmas, Halloween adventures. We have dinner on the trains that are very good, four-course meals. We also partner with some folks up in Etowah, Tennessee, for the Hiawassee River Rail Adventure, which takes people into western North Carolina in the Hiawassee River Rail Basin.
Now, there's a connection here with the Civil War, isn't there?
Yes, you know, a lot of the Civil War history from this area was used for trains, and there's the tunnel that we actually go through was built in 1854 before the Civil War.
So a very historic railroad line.
Yeah, it's very, very historic, and we also run tours down to the Chickamauga Battlefield. So those are going to become very popular as the sesquicentennial.
Here it is, right on time.
This is our new 630 that was created in 1903 for the Southern Railway. And it cost us over $600,000 to refurbish in 11 years to actually do the work. And so it'll run through the end of this year, which is our 50th anniversary. We actually were started in 1961. And all of our history and all of our information is on the internet at tvrail.com. We have a brand new website that has all of our excursions on it for people to see. My name is Robert Petway, and I work with the Tennessee Valley Railroad Museum. Thank you.
Awesome, Robert. Thank you.
All right.
Now let's head over to Branson, Missouri, and climb aboard the Branson Scenic Railroad.
All aboard!
My name is Vic Mitchell. We have two runs that we make from the Branson Depot. Right now we're on the south route and we're going into Arkansas. Both routes last an hour and 45 minutes, and we'll probably get in about nine and a half miles into Arkansas, stop on a trestle, and then return to the depot in our time allocated.
Tell us about the rolling stock. This is some great historic cars.
Oh, yeah. We have quite a few vintage cars. We have seven, actually. Cars range from 1939, built by the Budd Company in Pennsylvania. Another car that was a 1947 model. We have another one is a 1949. We have two built in 1952. And then we have two built in 1956.
And then you have your Sky Dome cars.
Twin Sky Dome cars, 1952 models, and then we have a 1947 Sky Dome. So love those cars. We take a lot of pride in it.
Well, they're still quite elegant and beautiful, aerodynamic and streamlined. And
right now we have them decorated for the Polar Express.
Tell us about the Polar Express. This is kids special.
Yeah, we have a lot of kids that'll be on, their parents or grandparents. We've seen all ages come on board, and many of them choose to wear pajamas like the movie. They have a great time. We play the music and we do the roles that the film had for everybody. The only thing we don't do is dance on the ceiling like they did in the movie. But other than that, things are just the way it was.
Tell us about some of the highlights of things that somebody would see.
Well, we have a lot of rolling hills and short mountains. And then we're going to go through two tunnels today. One is two-thirds of a mile long. Another one is one-half a mile long. One of them happens to be curved. The guys that dug those tunnels out were highly skilled. Dug out in 1903, so they've been here a long time. And then we have a couple trestles that we'll be going over. One is 113 feet above a creek. Another one is 122 feet above a wide valley. A beautiful scene of the Ozarks.
For further information, is
BransonTrain.com. The northern route we didn't talk yet about. It kind of circles Branson a little bit, see some of the stars' homes, and then straight north into the Reed Springs Galena area. It's a very scenic area as well.
Thank you, Vic.
Yes, we enjoy all the passengers, obviously, that come to Branson and want to take a train ride. You'd be surprised the number of people that have never been on a train. Many of the little kids, you know, think it's just absolutely wonderful. Their eyes light up all the time. My name is Vic Mitchell, and I'm the conductor here.
Roanoke Valley, situated in southwestern Virginia, offers hikers and bikers, wine seekers and foodies, an abundance of world-class things to do and see. The town of Roanoke, the gateway to the legendary Blue Ridge Parkway and Mountains, is an especially enchanting place. Catherine Fox, Director of Tourism and Communications for the Roanoke Valley Conference and Visitors Bureau. Hallelujah, bye, bye. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Tom. Welcome to Roanoke.
Well, as you know, I literally just drove in minutes ago, so this is all new to me.
You know, this town, it is what it is today because of our railroad heritage. And the railroad, many, many years ago, chose this area as a crossing. The Shenandoah and the Tennessee Railroad all came here as a crossing and then eventually turned into Norfolk and Western Railway. And in 1882, really established a stronger presence as the Norfolk and Western Railway took off. And now it's Norfolk Southern. So the heritage is still here today. We have so many people who are so inclined to relive that heritage. And we have an active freight track. We have two museums that really expand on that history, both from the standpoint of photography and then one in the standpoint of the actual engines, the actual rail collection.
Let's join Bev Fitzpatrick, the Executive Director of the Virginia Museum of Transportation in Roanoke, Virginia.
My name is Bev Fitzpatrick. I'm the Executive Director of the Virginia Museum of Transportation. We're located in Roanoke, where the Norfolk and Western Railroad was headquartered for 100 years. We are the official state transportation museum, and our real claim to fame is that we have a lot of railroad equipment, a couple of locomotives which were literally designed and built here in Roanoke by Norfolk and Western employees from mostly the 1930s through the 1950s. Two of the locomotives, Class J 611, which is a passenger locomotive, and Class A 1218, a freight locomotive, were used during the war exclusively. One was built in 1950 and only operated for 9 years before they decided to go to diesel. And 1218, which is the larger freight locomotive, was built in 1943 during the war. Usually it took 6 to 8 weeks to build them. It was built in 2 weeks. It weighs over 1 million pounds. So Roanoke played a significant role in World War II in the rail effort for transporting troops and materials. We also have some trucks and automobiles and a small number of aircraft here. But what we really focus on is the history of Roanoke and how transportation, specifically the railroad, took a small little community and turned it into a major metropolitan city.
Railroad still remains a vital part of the community, isn't it?
Absolutely. After 100 years, the Norfolk Southern, well, the Norfolk Western merged with the Southern, and they moved the headquarters to Norfolk, Virginia. But we have a major office building and had huge operations, both in maintenance of diesel locomotives and also as a major yard for the Norfolk Southern. So we have more employees in the operating side in Roanoke now than we did before the merger.
Oh, interesting. Somebody yesterday told me that as far as your growth, industry, and employment, that there is a company here that builds rail cars that has added some new employees.
That's
Tell us
right.
about that.
The Norfolk and Western used to build their own coal cars or gondolas or whatever. Some years ago, that became cost sensitive, and so they closed them down. Well, Freight Car America, headquartered in Chicago, came in and has leased that property from the Norfolk Southern, and now they're building like 1,500 coal hoppers for the Norfolk Southern Railroad, and they do for other railroads as well. What that has recently led to is 400 jobs in Roanoke, which is fantastic.
Welders and everything, the whole gamut. Then.
Welders, painters, machinists, you know, you name it, we've got it. We still have a large number of machine tool skilled folks here because of the railroad background. Virginia had two big places with machine tool skills, the Tidewater area around Norfolk because of Newport News Shipbuilding was there and still is there, and then Roanoke. My name is Bev Fitzpatrick. For further information on the Virginia Museum of Transportation, please feel free to go to our website, vmt.org, and we'd love to have your questions or comments. We're also on Facebook.
Bev, thank you very much. This has been great.
Thank you, Tom. A pleasure.
A fantastic rail walk which connects the two to give that historical picture.
So you're walking right alongside actual rail beds, then?
Yes, and it's a fabulous way to really relive that.
I'm getting hungry. Let's talk about food.
Oh, I'm one of my favorite subjects. Just in the downtown area alone, we would find probably, 30 to 50 restaurants, and ranging from the Texas Tavern, where you can get a bowl of chili with onions. It's been in business since 1930, 24 hours a day. It'll cure any ailment.
Come along and let's head downtown to the Texas Tavern and visit with the owner, Matt Bullington.
That's why we have chili.
You got chili. All right, that's
good. Can
I get a...
We got cheesy whip and cheese apple
there, please. Hi, Matt. How are you?
Hey, how are you doing? I'm doing great.
All right. Tell us about your moniker about the 1,000 people eating here.
Well, we seat 1,000 people. 10 at a time. Got 10 stools.
Love it. This place is a true icon of Roanoke, and it goes way back. Tell us a little bit about the history.
We're an institution. We've been here since 1930. Our great-grandfather opened February 13, 1930, in the middle of the Depression. We've been open since then, virtually unchanged. You see these walls around you, see this counter, see that grill, essentially everything except the people that work here. Other than that, it's the way it looked when we opened door. My great-grandfather, he was the advance man for the Ringham Brothers Circus, which meant he would go around town to town and set up the affairs of the circus prior to it coming. And he did that, and he found some recipes throughout his travels throughout America, the relish recipe, the chili, and a few other things. In particular, he found a chili recipe he liked in a hotel in San Antonio, then decided he wanted to open a restaurant. It got out of the circus business, it saved up some money, and opened up here in 1930.
Grandfather, and then your father, and then you?
My father had gotten involved, I think, around 67. I started here in 1994.
And it's total local trade from what I can see. 10 minutes ago it was packed with tradesmen and...
We call ourselves Roanoke's Millionaires Club. I have had bankers sitting next to homeless people. I've had judges sitting next to people that just got out of jail. Everyone comes in the Texas Tavern. Doesn't matter what your status is. Mm-hmm. You leave it outside, you come in, we'll treat you like a millionaire. It's just white collar, blue collar, no collar. They all come in here. We're going on our 82nd anniversary, and people crave something that's unique. They crave something different from the cookie cutter, homogenous corporate landscape. True Americana.
Tell us shorthand here at the Texas Tavern.
If you want a hamburger, you just say, I want one. If you want onions on it, it's one with. If you want a hot dog, you order as a hot. So if you want everything on it, you order as with. If you come in, you order a bowl of chili, you don't say a bowl of chili with onions, you just say bowl with. If you want a hamburger with everything on it, one with. Cheesy Western is just a cheesy. It's our most famous sandwich. It actually got us included in the book Hamburger America by George Motes. The Cheesy Western is a cheeseburger with a fried egg on it. And we have a homemade relish that we make here. It has a mustard base. Relish, pickles, and onions on it.
Your prices, they don't look like they've changed in 50 years either. Bowl of chili, $1.60?
$1.60 for a bowl of chili.
Two eggs and toast, $2. That's not a historic menu.
I probably have the best price on breakfast anywhere in town.
Toast and sausage gravy for $1.30. Bacon and egg sandwich, $2.20.
Our chili is what we're really known for. We had our 75th anniversary a few years ago. I tallied up how many bowls we'd sold, essentially, and it's over 20 million bowls of chili we've served. We're open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, so our busiest time is 2 a.m. on a Friday or Saturday night. It's just wall-to-wall in here and line out the door.
Amazing. Matt Bullington, the owner of Texas Tavern in the heart of downtown Roanoke, Virginia. What a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Pleasure's all mine.
Good point to end on because we're out of time. Catherine Fox, it's been a pleasure. For further information for the listener, a website.
Oh, yes. Visit Roanoke, Roanoke, VA, Virginia.com.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tom. We're glad to have you here.
We've been speaking with Catherine Fox, the Director of Tourism and Communications for the Roanoke Valley Convention and Visitors Bureau.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Roanoke Valley, Virginia.
Oh, how glad and happy when we meet, I'll fly away. Oh, how glad and happy when we meet, I'll fly away.
Last but by no means least on our railroad journey across America today is a visit to the Lahaina and Kanapali sugarcane train on the island of Maui.
We're located in Lahaina, Maui, Hawaii. Never really operated as a real sugar cane train, but it's designed after that faction.
Your engines, are they former cane engines?
No, they actually were from a lime quarry in Pennsylvania, but remodeled to resemble the engines. Our coaches, however, were designed by King Kalakaua, and we manufacture them right on the property. We build them from the ground up. We get flat cars and build them. And he used to ride on it when he and his entourage and royal family would take a tour of his plantations. They didn't take the plantation workers to the fields, which people thought they did. That wasn't what happened. These are more upscale than that. But we don't want to ever lose the sugarcane industry that made Hawaii what it is today in a very big way. And we're doing our part to keep that alive. And that's why we haven't changed the name of the sugarcane train, which is our affectionate name, because we feel that we can do our part to keep that history going.
And then your engineer, your onboard staff, they talk story about the history and what you see when you're on the train.
Absolutely. They talk about the sugarcane industry, and they also talk about the Molokai, Lanai, Kanapali, the golf course, the mountains, and all of the history, King Kalakaua, all those guys. And there comes the train now.
How many times a day does this train come and go?
We have 4 round trips a day, and we also have a dinner train on Thursday evenings.
Watch the train come in.
All right. That's Terry, our conductor, with the hat on. Very colorful gentleman. That's his job, to be colorful. And Stan, he's from Czechoslovakia. He's serving as a fireman today. He's usually our chief mechanic, but we're shorthanded today. But that's Stan.
Will we have a chance to talk to him?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, they'll be here for 15 minutes.
Oh. Aloha.
Aloha, how are you?
Swell, how are you?
What would you like to know about the train?
Well, you tell me. I know nothing.
Well, let's see. This is basically a continuation of a railroad that started in 1882 to haul the sugarcane from the fields into the mill. It operated until 1952. Then there was a hiatus of about 17 years. A man named Mac McKelvey decided to build a railroad again. He scrounged together bits and pieces. The two locomotives we used most of the time came from Limestone Quarry in Ohio. It started running again in 1969. Since then, we've hauled over 6 million passengers. Even though we started in 69, we feel like our heritage goes back to 1879. The first railroad in Hawaii was here on Maui.
Where did it run from, too?
The original railroad started over in Kahului and went up the hill to Wailuku, and then it went the other way over to Paia, if you know where that's at. From Paia, it went up to Haile Mailie. Ran about 37 miles of track back then, including the highest railroad trestle in the Pacific. It was 230 feet tall.
Wow, very good. And how many people do you haul per day here?
Oh, it varies a lot. Anywhere from about 150 up to about 450, depends on the season.
And what do you love most about working on the railroad?
Let's see, probably meeting the people. We have visitors from literally all over the country. Of course, the majority come from the mainland or Japan, but have visitors from all over Europe, Africa, South America, all the other islands in the Pacific. Just a lot of fun to get to meet people. And we have a lot of people that are really into steam trains. We call them foamers because they foam at the mouth when they get around the steam train. That's always fun.
Well, thank you very, very much. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you, and aloha.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
Associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Molly Blaisdell, San Francisco, and Katya Sengel, San Luis Obispo, California.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. People often associate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul with thrift stores. Donations like clothing, your gently used couch, or still serviceable washing machine generate funds to assist the Society in putting food on the table for people in need, or keeping the lights on and families in their homes. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org. Once again, svdpusa.org. And whether you're shopping for new or used items, donating them, or volunteering, you're helping the Society of St. Vincent de Paul help others.